A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 236. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about The Picture of Dorian Gray. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England. Hello. So, 1976, and it's on the BBC. It's a production of Oscar Wilde's famous novel of the same name, The Picture of Dorian Gray. This production ran to about 100 minutes. It's a colour production. It is a BBC costume drama, so we'll talk about that later, but costumes and sets look a certain way, quite good-looking production. And of course, it's the classic tale of the corruption of a young man's soul with a strange supernatural twist, which we will also get to, although I suspect most people know the backstory to The Picture of Dorian Gray, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And even though it is familiar, let's talk a bit about the setup of this. The artist, Basil Hallward, is completing a portrait of the young, handsome gentleman, Dorian Gray. And the work is also observed by the much older Lord Henry Wotton, who muses about the ideas of beauty and the sort of hedonistic view of life that is quite central to this.
Yes, Lord Wotton, who will feature regularly throughout this production, popping up from time to time to say various witty things, but also to sort of make some of the statements which lead to what happens to Dorian Gray. But here we are in the artist's studio looking at this fine portrait, and Lord Henry's musings lead Dorian Gray to sort of wish that his portrait would age and that he would remain as he is instead of the other way around. And it's almost a casual statement made in conversation as they discuss beauty and aging. But of course, it leads to some interesting consequences.
Yes, absolutely. And it is sort of a statement that is very offhand, but becomes the central thing that things hinge on, which is an interesting way to do things.
Okay, let's run through our characters. Obviously, we've got the title character himself, Dorian Gray, played by the young Peter Firth. I think this is a couple of years before he played Dominic Hyde in The Flip Side of Dominic Hyde, which we've talked about previously on British Invaders, when he played a time traveller. But here he is as very much the epitome of a young, handsome Victorian gentleman about town, charming, good-looking, young. But as the production and the story progress, his behaviour will deteriorate and it will become more debauched. And the reasons for that we will also touch on later on.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a very strong set of themes in here about the behaviour changing and becoming less good and upright over time. Basil Hallward, who is the painter, of course, played by Jeremy Brett, who would go on about a dozen years later to play Sherlock Holmes and be, well, my favorite film and TV Sherlock Holmes, I think, but certainly one that has gotten a lot of critical respect over the years.
Probably the definitive Holmes.
Maybe so. But in this case, he's Basil Hallward, the artist who produced this wonderful work of art that's the portrait that becomes so central to things. And his character is also an important ongoing part of the story.
Then we've got Lord Henry Wotton, who we've mentioned already, played by John Gielgud, no less. the hugely distinguished British stage, television and film actor. And here he is as the perfect purveyor of Oscar Wilde's wit. He is the chap who we can rely on to say various witty epigrams that just seem characteristic of Oscar Wilde. I've jotted down one that's probably not relevant to the plot, but where he says, "Men marry because they are tired, women marry because they are curious, both end up disappointed." But there's more of those to come as we go through. And it's his views on life and beauty and, as you've said, hedonism that lead Dorian astray, lead him from the straight and narrow. But of course, while Dorian remains young and beautiful, Lord Henry Wotton does age himself and becomes desperate himself to know what Dorian's secret is, which is featured in later scenes in the production.
Yes, definitely a pivotal character and one with interesting points of view and perspective on things, for sure. Sybil Vane was played by Judy Bowker, who was Andromeda in Clash of the Titans, of all things. And she is a beautiful young actress who Dorian is quite taken with and romances her and then ultimately deserts her with rather tragic consequences. And that is sort of a significant turning point for Dorian's character and where he becomes a harder and more cruel type of individual.
Yes, they seem like the perfect pairing, Dorian Gray and Sybil Vane. But as you say, that's going to go horribly wrong on the start of Dorian's descent. So as we say, we've got the handsome and charming young man from these opening sequences, but he becomes nastier and nastier as he listens to Lord Henry and succumbs to the various pleasures and debaucheries that life can provide. Lord Henry at one point says something like, "The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it." And that seems to be advice that Dorian Gray takes to heart. And as we've said, his innocent relationship with this beautiful young actress, Sybil, is corrupted. He deserts her. The consequences are quite terrible. And it will lead to Sybil's brother seeking revenge later on in the story.
Yes, that's certainly how things go with this. And around Dorian Gray, other characters are aging and changing, and the servants are replaced, people come and go, but Gray is always the same. And in outward appearance, he is always this young and seemingly innocent character, even though we know from his actions that he becomes very different from that. And of course, he takes Hallward's painting up to his attic and hides it away, not only in the attic, but underneath a thick cloth to conceal it. And in order to conceal his secret, he will go to any extent, it seems, which of course ultimately includes murder. So we certainly get the changes in the character over time.
Yes, we certainly do. And I did like the way that they sort of indicated this with subtle changes in the age and makeup of Jeremy Brett and John Gielgud, while Peter Firth remains as youthful and good looking as ever. And I thought the way that they also changed background characters, he gets new manservants and so on. That sort of indicated the passage of time, because as we know, there is a secret to this painting that we won't see after the first scenes, because it's hidden away, as you've said, Brian, in the attic covered by a cloth. But somehow this painting is keeping Dorian young and keeping him innocent as well, or at least appearing to be innocent, because the ravages of his debauched lifestyle do not show on his youthful visage. So something strange and mysterious is going on.
Yes, absolutely. The wish that the painting would change and he would not, instead of the other way around, is exactly what happens in the story.
So let's turn to our production notes for The Picture of Dorian Gray. And we begin, of course, with Oscar Wilde, dates 1854 till his death in 1900, an Irish-born playwright, novelist, well-known wit and socialite. His famous works include Salome, and that was 1891, Lady Windermere's Fan a year later, a couple years later, An Ideal Husband, and then in 1895, possibly his most famous play, Importance of Being Earnest.
Quite an impressive set of things for anyone. He really was a very important figure in English literature of that era.
Yes, and before all those famous plays, he was already well known as a magazine editor. He was a critic, an essayist, and in July 1890, he published The Picture of Dorian Gray as the lead story in one of those magazines that were so popular in Victorian times. This one was called Lippincott's Monthly Magazine. We touched on these when we talked about Dickens' short stories, I think about The Signalman, but magazine publication for stories was a huge thing in the 19th century, Brian.
Yes, and at that point, a lot of things were being serialized. So you had novels that would be published one chapter or one section at a time, serially. And that wasn't the case with this. This was a shorter version of The Picture of Dorian Gray than the one where most of us are familiar with. And it was, I believe, just published all at once in that July issue in 1890. And the story provoked a storm of critical outrage. It was considered very controversial. Some reviewers were even suggesting that Wilde should be prosecuted for offenses against public morality. So you had this real sense of it being a very controversial and risque type of story that was not something that was typically being done at the time and was really pushing the edge of what was considered acceptable.
It's fascinating that there were so many outrages at various literary publications in the late 19th century. Clearly, these magazines and books were being much more closely sort of scrutinized, I guess. I suppose the equivalent in our modern culture would be television and film that causes offense and moral outrages. But certainly the Victorians were paying a lot of attention to these literary works.
And it may also be that this was a time when things were changing, and it was the point where stories and literature could start to deal with issues that had been taboo previously. And that was certainly the case with The Picture of Dorian Gray. It crossed a lot of taboos. Now, about a year later, in 1891, Oscar Wilde revised and extended the story, and the novel was published, which is much more the version that has lived on that we are familiar with. And this version actually included a preface which defended the artist's rights to create offense, to be offensive in literature, which was interesting that it was sort of a point that he felt had to be made.
Yes, Wilde, I guess, defended himself in his preface to the actual novel. Although it's interesting that he did actually make some changes and he did remove some of the passages from the original story that had caused the most trouble. Now, certainly, I'm no Wildean scholar, but Wikipedia suggests that he had to downplay some of the homoerotic references in this story. interestingly, things that perhaps the BBC in 1976 were able to put back in, or at least hint at more strongly. So obviously it's a slightly changed version from the magazine version. It's a longer version, but there are bits that have been removed by Wilde, and it's the version that we've been looking at for this production. And another interesting thing about it that I picked up was that Oscar Wilde said the novel contained three versions of himself. Hal Wood, the artist, is what he thought he was. Lord Henry Wotton is how society saw him, is what society thought of him. And young Dorian Gray was what he wanted to be himself. So interesting, Wilde turning his own wit upon his own works.
That is very interesting, and I think it takes an author as sophisticated as Oscar Wilde to do something like that, to have sort of those different versions and perspectives turned into different characters. Very interesting stuff for sure. The Picture of Dorian Gray has been adapted for film and television quite a number of times. In fact, Wikipedia lists a total of 22 different film and television adaptations, going right back to 1910.
Yes, interesting. Another Victorian character that appears in lots of works. And he's also sort of spun off into other projects or other related media, because his character turns up in the film of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which he doesn't actually appear, I think, in the graphic novel that it's based on, but he appears in the Sean Connery movie of the same name. And I believe the character's also turned up in the recent TV series Penny Dreadful, which I hear good things about, but I've yet to see any of it myself, I'm afraid. And he's turned up in another place, Brian.
Yes, Big Finish Productions, one of our favourite production houses for doing audio dramas, did a series of audios called The Confessions of Dorian Gray, which uses the character and sort of changes things around a little bit in such a way as to make him a character that they can use sort of throughout the 20th century and beyond. And they did some lovely things with the character that way in that. And they also, after Confessions had started, they did an adaptation for audio of the original novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, as well. So they did some lovely work there.
Splendid and worth listening to.
Yes, for sure. It's also worth noting that Jeremy Brett played Dorian Gray in a 1961 production of the novel by Sidney Newman's Armchair Theatre on ITV. So Jeremy Brett once played Dorian Gray, and then years later, here he is playing Basil Hallward. So interesting that he got to play both of those characters on television.
That's a fascinating little tidbit from this show. And, you know, it must have been an interesting and obvious irony for Jeremy Brett, now being too old to play the Dorian Gray character that he previously played in the early 60s. So he's playing the artist Hal Wood. It's fascinating. I love stuff like that.
Yes, it was certainly neat to see that.
So this production we've been watching from 1976 comes from the BBC's Play of the Month series, which I confess I didn't know too much about before. It's a series that ran from 1965 to 1983, and it adapted works of classic fiction as opposed to modern plays, which appeared in the its sibling, the Play for Today series, which we have touched upon in the past. So here we have Play of the Month, classic fiction adaptations.
The idea of these play series in British television were really quite important. There were a number of them running in, certainly in the 60s and all the way through the 80s, that were really about treating things in a way like live drama, where they would have original play productions or adaptations of things, but they would be thinking of them as stage drama in many ways. And it was something that was sort of a regular thing that was, you know, one of the standard parts of the television schedule that was, you know, that was quite important to how things went.
And I suppose an indicator that this was the BBC doing their version of stage plays for the television is the fact that the very famous British playwright John Osborne adapted the Picture of Dorian Gray for this production we've been watching. John Osborne, I suppose, most famous for his 1956 play Look Back in Anger, which sort of introduced the idea of the angry young man to British culture and society. And here he is doing the adaptation for the screen and doing a pretty good job with it, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And it was directed by John Gorey, who had a long and successful career as a television director. We, of course, remember him from directing Doctor Who, The Keys of Marinus, way back in the early 60s, and doing a few episodes of Out of the Unknown. He also directed Shakespeare for television, and he did one episode of Sherlock Holmes with Jeremy Brett. So that's another connection. The two of them would, years later, work together with Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes. The music for this was original, and it was written by Joseph Horowitz.
And sounds very good, and it looks very good, because it's shot in studio with, I think, the usual excellent BBC costumes, so they all look very good. Not many sets, but again, the set dressing looks very impressive, and they use them well. I think it certainly looks like Victorian gentlemen's homes and rooms. So in terms of the look of the production, it's pretty good.
It's one of many examples of British television and the BBC doing period drama very well. You know, they had the resources to really make period pieces look good, and that was certainly what happened here. The Picture of Dorian Gray was broadcast on September 19th of 1976 on BBC One.
And we believe it was a critical success at the time. I haven't been able to find any reviews from the time, but we know that in 2009, the Times newspaper did a sort of look back at various adaptations of Wilde's work and declared this production the most Wildean version of the novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. So the Times certainly liked it back then and more recently.
Yes, that's interesting. I think Osborne did a very nice job of capturing the spirit of it and capturing some of what Wilde had done with it originally.
So it's time to talk about availability and getting hold of this production if you want to watch it. Here in Region 2, we have a BBC box set, the Oscar Wilde Collection. Came out in 2005, includes four BBC plays of Wilde works. So we've got this one. We've got An Ideal Husband from 1969, interestingly directed by Rudolf Cartier of Quatermass fame. We've got Lady Windermere's Fan from 1988, and also we've got The Importance of Being Earnest from 1988 with Paul McGann in there. So interesting other productions, plus there's a bonus feature, a 60-minute extra on the 3-DVD set called The Life and Loves of Oscar Wilde. And you can get all that here in the UK for £9.60 currently on Amazon.co.uk. And it's also available to rent by post if you have a Love Film account, although I can't find it on any other rental sites. But it is a fairly cheap box set for four interesting productions.
There is a lot there, and it's some lovely stuff, so that's quite good.
And in Region 1 this time, Brian, slightly more hopeful.
Yes, in Region 1, there is a release of the Oscar Wilde collection, which I believe is almost identical to the British release, although this one came out a few years later in 2008. But I believe the contents on that are the same. It runs for about $18 on Amazon.com and about $31 on Amazon.ca. So certainly from Amazon.com and from Amazon.co.uk for the Region 2 version, some pretty reasonable prices for a very nice set of productions that you won't see elsewhere, I think.
Yes, interesting package, and very nice to have it available in a Region 1 box set as well.
Yes, absolutely. So next time, we will get to the picture itself, and we will talk about some of the adaptations of classic 19th century horror novels, which certainly include this one, so it's some nice stuff to talk about there.
Plus, we'll start to get into our own feelings about this show. We'll give our reviews and come to our recommendations about whether this is one to add to your list. So plenty to talk about when we come back.
Yes, absolutely. Until then, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com, and you can also search for British Invaders on Facebook, and you will find our Facebook group, and we have some nice discussions and comments and things going on there.
Or you can come and join the fun at the Voice of Geeks streaming radio network. That's VogNetwork.com. Come along and listen to some other geek-related shows. Get involved, say hello, tell them Brian and Eamon sent you.
Yes, absolutely. We broadcast on Mondays and Tuesdays there. Monday is a good evening slot for North American listeners, and if you're in the UK or Europe, the Tuesday one is a better match for the evening.
Splendid stuff.
So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Until next time, it's Eamon in England also signing off.